Pushkin.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented three new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at marketmessage2024.com right now. Again, the link to watch is marketmessage2024.com. That's marketmessage2024.com.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Today we have friend of the show Jack White back on the program, along with a very special visit from one of my favorite artists of all time. If you missed our last conversation with Jack, Brennan Benson, and the rest of the Raconteurs, I highly recommend going back to listen. This conversation, like the one before, is full of fascinating ideas, asides, and musical history that lets you know just how deep a cat Jack White really is. It's as if he's tapped into some sort of endless creative energy and inspiration. And some of that inspiration, he tells Rick in this conversation, is still emanating from his youth. Jack also has a work ethic and a business ethos unlike most. His label Third Man Records has a rich roster of artists with three retail stores in Detroit, Nashville, and London. They also own one of the few fully operational vinyl pressing plants in the US, which has been working overtime lately to keep up with the surging demand for vinyl. Jack also released two full-length albums this year that perfectly document his present creative life. And he's on a worldwide tour promoting those records. After a recent two-night stand in LA, Jack stopped by Shangri-La to speak with Rick Rubin about the early garage rock scene in Detroit that helped shape him, what makes the Seven Nation Army guitar riff one of the greatest earworms of all time, and then Jack treats Rick and a legendary surprise guest to an acoustic performance of his new song, A Tip From You to Me. And to cap it all off, we'll hear exclusive details about an exciting new project Rick's been working on that'll be out soon. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Rick Rubin and Jack White from Shangri-La.
Are you on the road now?
Yeah, we just did these last two nights we played in town, and then day off today, so
great.
Yeah, so you said hey, so I thought, oh, it'd be a good time because I've been wanting to have an excuse to come out here again.
And what's the current band situation?
So three guys with me, drums, bass, and keys.
And guys you've played with before?
Yes, Dominic Davis, who's on bass, and we've been playing together since we're like 13. We go way back to Detroit, and Daru Jones on drums, and who's probably, I think, really the most unique drummer around today, really. And then Quincy McCrary plays keys and sings harmonies too.
Great. So
I debated going on as a three piece. I always wanted to do that, and I got to try that out on when we did Saturday Night Live year and a half ago or whatever it was. That was a good moment because we weren't pushing anything or anything. So we did that, and I felt, oh wow, that would be nice to tour as a trio. But then there's a whole like bank of like 40 songs that have keyboards that we wouldn't really be able to perform, and that we have to just kind of cross that off the possible list.
Do you feel an obligation to have keyboards in a keyboard song, though? Could you basically do a three-piece band cover of?
Yes, I would love that. My worry was that, you know, I even worried about that in the Waste Tribes, which was breaking things up and sometimes playing keys or synth on a song or acoustic on a song, so it wasn't the same. You're not hearing the same tones over and over again. That's always my concern, and I don't want things to sound wimpy either. You know, so sometimes I love an acoustic track, but playing it live, you're in that room and it's. You just got done playing three very fast rock and roll songs, and you feel like, you can't tell if you're losing them, the audience, or if they're actually just,
if they're actually listening,
paying attention more or something, you know. So it's hard to know, but I like that because it keeps me on edge the whole time.
Yeah. What's your relationship to rocking material versus non-rocking material in general?
Yeah, I sometimes think that the things that I like more are not as appealing to other people. for example, a great example is I would just like to be a drummer, you know, but I know that my drumming is just, you know, it doesn't capture people and capture their attention and make them go, wow, wait a minute, or I play piano, but no one considers me a piano player by any means. I definitely wouldn't claim that either, but it, for some reason, when I play guitar, it connects with people and they come back with feedback and they give me feedback and want to push me to keep doing that. Where that's the one instrument for the, I'm like, the last one I would pick was guitar, you know? Yeah. I mean, just like everybody plays guitar and it's been done a million times. And how do you have your own voice and uniqueness to it? And maybe because of my sort of carelessness about that, maybe by accident, there's some uniqueness ended up happening because of me sort of thinking, oh, whatever, I guess.
Interesting.
It's like if you wrote a poem and you could read it out loud and you maybe could get a few people to pay attention and get something out of it and connect with some other people. If you put it to a melody and sing those words as a reading, then all of a sudden you got more people paying attention possibly. And then if you put music behind it and then a rhythm behind it, who knows? You could go to a billion people could be interested in. I think that's kind of the way I feel. I like, okay, this is the window to, if I can tell the story to you, if I need to use this instrument to do it, okay, if that's what you want, okay, let's do that.
Can you imagine, with your love of drums, could you imagine playing drums for a band that already connected with people on a different level where it wasn't on you to be the connector, but you could just be the drummer?
It'd be great. It'd be great. Yeah, I play drums in my band, The Dead Weather, and I'm the drummer in that band, but it's a darker band. It's more esoteric and darker. So it's not really, we never intended to have it, hoping it had a large popular reach or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Which sounds like a cynical, like hipster thing to say, like on purpose, trying not to, you know, whatever. But it really wasn't that way. I'm saying that because I wasn't expecting, oh, great, the heat's off me.
Yeah,
I can just drum. But yeah, it would be wonderful. You know, it would be wonderful to be that.
Tell me about your relationship to success in terms of when you're writing. Do you ever think who's going to like this or what's the right presentation to make somebody respond?
Early on, coming out of the garage rock scene in Detroit, it was a lot of people who were talented, who were keeping themselves down on purpose or boxing themselves in a weird way of not wanting it to succeed in any way or to grow in any bigger way. I always thought that's a really strange thing. It's almost like a painter who never puts his paintings up on the wall or puts them in a gallery. I mean, if you're not sharing with other people, I guess what's the point in a way? You're just doing it by yourself. Maybe you should just stay at home or something. Mm-hmm. And it's just a hobby again. Mm-hmm. But if you're going up on stage and you're putting out a record with your name on it or whatever, it feels like you're already in that world anyway. You're already sharing with other people. Mm-hmm. I guess people always say something like, doesn't it make you mad that they play your Seven Nation Army song at sports stadiums? I'm like, why would that make me mad?
It's incredible.
I think Kurt Cobain sort of brought a little bit more of that to the surface of punk rock guilt. Where you're, he may have felt guilty about the attention, from what I hear or from what's always gathered about him, and I felt like that was definitely a vibe in the sort of the hipster garage rock world that we came out of, was that you're almost supposed to be ashamed if something worked out well.
Yeah, it's odd. And it's an odd. It's an odd way of thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's some belief, and I do not subscribe to this belief that if something's successful, it can't be good.
Right.
And and I don't think that's right. I really don't think that's right.
No,
I think
it's not.
A lot of the stuff that's successful, I might not like.
Yeah.
But things do break through that are amazing.
Yeah.
And those are the revolutionary things.
Yes. I mean, there'll be times though, there'll be a pop song where you might instantly hear it and be cynical about it and say, oh God, give me a break, you know, or a cliche, or it's pretentious or something like that. And then what I'll do is I'll realize, well, you know, that's hard, man. That's really hard if you want to sit down and write a hit that's going to be number one on the charts or whatever, especially nowadays. That's no easy task. And so then you have to give credit for that. Like, hey, even if you don't like it, you got to give someone credit. They actually made it work. They figured it out. Yeah. Even if they wanted to do it every single time, they couldn't do it. So you start thinking about it that way. And then maybe sometimes like time passes and you start realizing, wow, that was really a important, beautiful thing that happened when that song became popular. Even novelty songs.
Yes.
Like I think of songs in the 80s that I thought were just, you know, these novelty, goofy things that were on the radio that now when I look back, I'm like, wow, damn, you know. Take On Me by A-ha.
Incredible.
Wow.
Incredible. Yeah.
Think about the structure of the melody of that vocal alone, let alone the production of it. And if you would have asked me when I was, whatever, 10, 12, I'm like, whatever.
Yeah.
But now I have immense respect for certain things like that. And it's funny that those things click with you at times, but I guess it's part of the craft when you get yourself involved in the craft and you care about it and you're open-minded.
Yeah.
I feel like maybe everyone has a choice, like as they age, you have a choice to go down this darker road where you become more and more closed-minded and more cynical and more hateful of anything that's different and scarier or imposing, or you stay down this road where you get more and more open-minded, more and more enlightened as you go, because you want to keep experiencing and you want to meet new people and hear new things. It's almost some kind of unconscious choice.
Yeah,
I used to think when I was younger, hey, you know, some old-timer musicians come into town and they're playing this club and we go see them and say, hey, come and talk to us after the show, and they wouldn't want to.
Yeah.
And I would think, God, that would be terrible. I wonder why they're so grumpy and grouchy. Well, now, I can see
now
why.
Now that you're grumpy and grouchy.
Well, I can see that he's like, there's been moments in my life where I could definitely have gone down that road. Like when I finish my show, I get in a car and go to the hotel and not talk to anybody. Yeah. I could see someone making that choice and why they would make that choice.
Yeah.
But you have to sort of shake that off. I'm like, yeah, but you miss so much. In a way, it's like a giving up for selfishness.
Yeah. Also, it is a grueling, I imagine it's grueling on the road, just like having to do it all the time.
Yeah.
And there's only so much energy and you want the show to be good every night.
Yeah.
So it seems like everything other than the show might suffer
for
the show to be all that it could be.
Yeah. When I see acts that are sort of maybe doing the same set every night and they have the pyrotechnics go off in song three and all that, I get a little jealous because I don't have a set list in my set. So when I see that, I'm like, oh man, that would be so easy and it would be so nice. You just go up there or say someone who stands still and sort of just can sing.
Yeah.
Like Willie Nelson doesn't really need to do anything. He didn't do acrobatics or anything. That voice is it. He's got it. It doesn't even probably require too much energy to push it out of himself. And it's amazing every time. You know, I don't have that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have a singer's voice. I'm not a singer, and I'm not even that kind of the character vocalist of like a Willie. I feel like to make something, it's a Wednesday night in Poughkeepsie, and you want this show to be great as it was, you know, Saturday night in New York City.
Yeah.
And, well, what am I going to do? And first, you have to care, you know.
Absolutely.
And there's another fork in the road where you find these moments where like, wow, you can see easily how quickly you'd want to give up and just go stay in the tour bus, blah, blah. I remember someone telling me that they were like, yeah, I used to look at the shows like, you know, two more songs and I get to go watch TV on the tour bus and one more song and get out of here. I'm like,
Countdown.
God, don't let that happen to me.
Yeah.
You know, that would be, I know what I would do. I just wouldn't tour anymore.
Yeah. And I can't imagine the shows are very good if that's the attitude of the performer.
Can't be, I guess.
Yeah.
Or say if what's popular now, Vegas residencies are popular now.
Yeah.
And I can get the appeal of that, you know, like maybe those artists, like they get paid already, no matter who shows up, it's the same dressing room every night. You get to take a private jet home to LA every night if you want to, or all these benefits and niceties and stuff. So I could see all that. But then I think, I don't know if it would work for me. I would feel like I gave up, like, for my own personal music. No judgment on that.
No,
like,
of course.
Some people, that makes, if you're Tom Jones, that's it, man. That's that's the way to go for what he's doing. And he's got the pipes for that. And maybe it would work for Willie Nelson in a way, in the right environment or something. But maybe for me, I would think, how could I do that and not give up and make it a different show every night and have energy to it? That would almost be its own challenge in its own.
And that sounds really fun. Like, that's a fun way to do it. Have you ever seen Willie live?
Yes. Yeah.
It's incredible.
It's great.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's not what I expected before I'd ever seen him.
Yeah.
I assumed it was going to be more like a country concert.
Yeah.
And it was more like a Ramones concert, other than the fact that the songs that he's singing. But
yes,
it was song on top of song on top of song. It was relentless.
And then, they do this, like, relentless. They'll do like a little buildup that you think would be like, God, it's almost like wimpy for a second. And so, like, Whiskey River, Don't Run Dry. And you're like, damn, that took, he didn't even really raise his voice.
No.
But all of a sudden, the energy went bam, like maybe with one little snare hit.
Yeah.
And so much to learn from that. And him as a guitar player.
Ridiculous.
So punk rock.
Yeah.
So punk. I mean, that guy, his guitar solos, if you haven't listened to a Willie Nelson guitar solo, anybody, I always say, God, man, just type in Willie Nelson guitar solo on the internet and listen to what he does. You won't believe it at first. You'll be like, wait, what?
Yeah.
You know, and it is so punk and so carefree and such a rebellious thing that I just kind of can't believe he got away with that. Even in the different environments he's worked in all the time, it's like, damn, that's a real rebellious outsider way to attack the guitar. You know?
Absolutely.
And the instrument he plays, the strange acoustic electric hybrid that has a matching amp built by like Wurlitzer or some, I forget what company made it, but it's a bizarre instrument that he chose that nobody else has as well. So very unique.
I wouldn't have thought to ask this before, but you talked about a song that plays in soccer stadiums.
Mm.
Have you ever tried to analyze what it is about Seven Nation Army that has transcended not only the rest of your work, but the rest of any rock artist's work? It has had a really unusual life.
Bizarre. Yeah.
Anything that you've noticed, maybe from playing it live, anything in, being a someone who studies music, you know, our passion is to study music.
Yeah.
We love trying to understand why it does what it does. Thoughts?
I've heard lots of opinions about it over the years. Yeah. You know, some being really positive and feeling it's groundbreaking. Other people trying to sort of like take it away from me or I say I copied something or on the negative side, and other people thinking that it's possibly, you know, I don't know what the word is, but, you know, something like when music is related to a heartbeat or that it has an organicness to it that maybe just got accidentally unearthed in that scenario. But I did read an article once about why do we like music at all from a scientist's point of view. And it was, you know, really scientific and methodical. And it was an interesting thing. The theory in this article was the brain is trying to make patterns and make sense of patterns, and that we find a thrill in when we can complete the melody pattern in our head or guess what it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can guess if you go, I know what the last two notes are going to be. You know, maybe that's a pleasantness to that. And then when you don't do that,
you're waiting for something.
Resolve it. And then maybe that gets into like why horror films are appealing to people. Like, it shouldn't on paper be like, well, why would you want to be scared? That doesn't make any sense. But we like it. We find it a thrill. And maybe that Seven Nation Army with the melodies. There seems to be two moments in there if I were to analyze it.
Yeah.
And I'm just taking a guess. Yeah. I have no idea. But this is, you know, that sounds like you're going to go up like, or something like that.
It's on the way up.
But you go up and then you quickly change direction. You know, dun, 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 now I'm going back down.
That gets you to pay attention.
Yeah, so wait, how's it going to resolve?
Why did it change direction?
Exactly, why did it change direction? So then you got, and then this next one is sort of what I think is maybe like the horror movie thing then.
like, whoa, okay, I guess I agree to that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not an actual full resolve. Yeah, but it's like, I can deal with that. Your brain can maybe say, yeah, I can deal with it. I don't know. It's just a guess that maybe those two little moments are what.
Is it the riff? Would you say the song is the riff?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
The funny thing was that I was at the time, I remember saying to Meg, this will be great. The challenge for me right now is I want to write a song with no chorus and make it something people like that doesn't have any chorus.
Yeah.
So that was at that moment, the challenge in the studio. Very briefly, we didn't spend much time on that song, you know. But I remember that being like, oh, this will be great. I won't write a chorus for this. Doesn't need one. We'll just keep hammering this. And then we'll play off the loud quietness of maybe the grunge era can be part of that. And there's also slide guitar in it too. And it's also sort of like a bass, but I'm not really playing bass. I'm playing a detuned guitar. So there was like, yeah, that's enough for things that I think are interesting.
So interesting.
Did you play guitar?
Barely, like punk rock, you know, like rudimentary guitar.
Who plays guitar on the Beastie Boys?
I played guitar in that.
On that first album? That's you. Oh, okay. I didn't know that. I thought you were going to say some studio guy's name. Like, great. Okay. What guitar did you use for that?
I had an SG Junior, 56 SG Junior.
Nice.
And that was my main guitar. And then I remember I saw Slayer, and I was really impressed with Slayer, and I met them, and Kerry King got me a Kerry King guitar, like a real metal guitar.
Yeah.
And I think I might have played one solo on that. I can't remember exactly, but I remember I had that. And then I ended up sending the guitar back after using it on the album.
Oh, like, shoot.
Yeah, because I didn't really like it, but I was just like, oh, this is fun for this kind of a thing.
Yeah. Why didn't Ed Rock play? Why did you play guitar on that one?
I don't really know.
Yeah.
I don't really know. Wasn't also the concept of the Beastie Boys as rappers.
Maybe they just had no instrumentation at that moment.
It wasn't supposed to be that. When they played, it was more like what the Beastie Boys, the band, sounded
punk,
like.
Yeah.
And we were doing something really different than that.
Yeah. I always had a sneaking suspicion, like when I was like 18 or something, I was like, I get the feeling, after I heard their punk records, I get the feeling like they did this rap thing because they thought it was funny at first, and then it just actually worked. So they stuck with it, and people dug it.
I think what happened, honestly, for all of us was we were all into punk rock.
Yeah.
And then hip-hop happened, and it's like hip-hop really took over for punk rock for us in real, like, as fans.
Sure, yeah.
So
yeah.
It just became more, it seemed disingenuous to keep making punk rock when all we did was listen to and love hip hop.
Right. And that was the new thing. That was the new punk rock.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. And you know, it was, for me, it was heavy metal before like I loved heavy metal music, or what I call heavy metal music, which is really rock, hard rock music.
Sure.
You know, I liked AC/DC and Aerosmith and Ted Nugent and those guys.
Yeah.
And then when I heard, well, I guess the Ramones, and then the Sex Pistols, and then the Clash, and then really Black Flag and the Germs. And I listened to much less hard rock once that started.
Do you think like Walk This Way would have worked with, and this isn't a, God, I wish you would have tried.
Yeah,
I'm just throwing out a hypothetical. Do you think that song would have worked with any other band? Like if you had tried that with Led Zeppelin or Deep Purple or any other track any other song?
The reason that Walk This Way worked had mostly to do with the vocal phrasing. That was the key. There were two pieces, actually. Yeah. So the one key was, the inspiration for that was, I went to dinner in Los Angeles with a head of a record company.
Yeah.
Who was trying to sign me.
Yeah.
And so he couldn't have been more like on good behavior and friendly.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, why do you think people like this rap stuff? After all, it's not music. Now he's saying this to me as like,
right, yeah, yeah.
Just completely oblivious.
Yeah.
That this is not, why would anybody like this thing that's not music?
Right, yeah.
And I thought, there's some way to bridge the gap. There's some way so that guy would understand what this is.
Sure, right.
And I just started listening to records and think about, okay, is there a record that's a familiar record that vocally is not so different from a rap record?
Yeah.
And the phrasing was, and it's not melodic.
Right,
the verse.
It's not. It's really the phrase.
Yeah. It's the phrasing.
Yeah.
So it could have been, what's the Dylan song?
Subterranean Homestead
yeah,
Blues.
Yeah, it could have been that. That would have worked.
Too Much Monkey Business, Chuck yeah, Berry.
No, that could have worked.
Yeah, yeah. It's so interesting.
It was something based on the phrasing. And then the extra added benefit for Walk This Way is that the drum break, the intro to the record was a drum break that you might hear in a hip-hop club in real
yeah,
life.
Exactly.
Like it was already yeah. considered in the hip-hop canon, not because of the song, but only because of the beat.
Right, right,
so it was
right,
this
right.
magical combination of a hip-hop friendly beat with hip-hop friendly phrasing.
Yeah.
And it really was just to demonstrate, oh, look, it's not that different. You know,
sure.
this is not foreign.
Right, exactly, yeah. yeah. It's funny, whenever there's a new style, a lot of the time, as you look back through music history, it seems like the main gripe from the majority of people is, this is a lowering of the bar.
Yeah.
This is a lowering since punk. All these guys don't know how to play their guitars.
Yeah.
You know, but
well,
somehow...
rock and roll, same thing.
Rock and roll
compared to
the
big band
before.
And jazz.
I thought something about, they were asked Quincy Jones what the jazz guys thought of the Beatles when they first got to America and all that. And he said something like, those were some no-playing motherfuckers, we
yeah.
thought. And everyone got kind of offended when he said that. And I thought, I shouldn't be offended by that because, I mean, stop for a second and think about the in complex chord changes and structures those jazz guys were doing and free-flowing off of that and everything. And to hear guys come and play three chords, four yeah. chords, and sing, and everyone's going ape and selling millions of records, it might make you a little bit like, geez, that's not, you know, wait a minute. But it's like that kind of thing where people can walk into a museum and say, oh, I could paint that. Well, no, you couldn't.
Yeah.
You got to come up with that idea,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
and then
conceptual.
You got to construct it. And the actual painting of the Jackson Pollock doesn't really matter. That the dripping part, whatever.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with punk rock. It doesn't really matter about the notes of it is the attitude behind it.
Yeah.
You had to construct that attitude or coerce it out of you from nothing, and that becomes more important than the proficiency of the music and all that. But that's usually the same thing. The same thing with hip hop. When it came along, he's not even playing instruments anymore. These
yeah.
aren't even instruments.
Yeah.
The funny thing now is, like, I kind of feel like, you know, modern sort of hip-hop production and hip-hop production, I'm taken back to the 80s, my feeling when I was 10, 12 years old. My feelings then were, it bummed me out that my friends didn't know that was Led Zeppelin being sampled on the Beastie Boys album.
Yeah.
And it pissed me off that I knew that and they didn't know that.
Yeah.
And then when I tried to educate them about that and play them a Led Zeppelin song, they just shrugged their shoulders like, I don't care.
Yeah.
And I was like, just as a young kid, I was like, if you like it, that's what's cool about it.
It's because
it's our, we already know that riff. And it's they're not even performing, they're actually sampling it. So that was frustrating to me as a kid that other people didn't, or be like, EPMD, I Shot the Sheriff,
yeah.
or... Now that's Eric Clapton covering Bob Marley.
Yeah,
and
it's so
nobody
cool.
else knew that in my neighborhood. And they didn't care. And I struggled with that a lot. Like, that bummed me out. I think now, I think it'd be safe to say if you played 100 teenagers the top 10 songs right now and asked them all, what is making this sound at this part of the song?
Yeah.
Who is performing this part of the... Or who? Where does this sound you're hearing coming from? I would venture to guess, and no diss on them, because why would they know
yeah.
that they wouldn't know what's making the sound? And what is that like? That's sort of like, I guess you could call it, some people would call it gatekeeping, where you'd say like, you must enjoy this the way I enjoy this, or something like that. But I always feel like, oh God, it would be frustrating
yes.
to come up in the age right now as a teenager, as a musician who wants to play music and not know how to make the sound of that moment of this Kanye West song or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But then the positive side of it is they can easily look it up on the internet and find out
yeah.
if they're really resourceful and maybe recreate it themselves. Whereas in our day, we would have had to go to the library, go to the music store, ask somebody, hey, what makes an echo do this kind of echo?
Yeah.
And then you'd have to do a lot of work to
Absolutely.
Figure something out.
Absolutely.
That's
and,
a dead beauty about also, right now. You can find out really fast.
For the question that you asked of like, what's in the, you know, what's the instrument playing in these, you know, this sound in the top 10, chances are the answer to all of that is, oh, it's the computer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I know when Rage Against the Machine came out, when that was why I embraced that instantly, was because I couldn't believe that guitar player was making his guitar sound like that. I even didn't believe it. There's no way he could make the guitar. How is he making it that sound? It's very rare when you hear a instrumentation where you don't know, and you know it's not some trick. You knew he's actually playing that at that time, 92 or something. Those are the moments you savor. You want these moments. I wish I had them once a week.
Like, the bass is so much of, like, what we think of the guitar riff is the bass.
You know,
it's like Deep Purple. We think of these huge guitar riffs that are really organ.
Organ-based, you know? Exactly, yeah.
It tricks you because the sound, your ear goes to the sound on top.
Yeah.
But sometimes the reason it has that scale and the reason you're impressed with it is because not the thing you think.
Yeah, the underneath, the growl underneath. That frustrates me now when I listen to earlier recordings I've done, is that I wanted to get that underneath deep growl. And even in a two-piece band like White Stripes, double tracking or adding something else didn't happen. And I didn't really know about subwoofer and double octave, you know, overdubbing and all these kind of things. And now these tricks I've learned over the years to bring those tones to fruition. But sometimes I think that at that time I was emulating maybe a Deep Purple sound that was coming from the growl of the Hammond organ and not from the guitar itself. You know, it takes a while to learn that stuff.
Absolutely. And you might find a new sound. You know, you're trying to get the Deep Purple sound and you end up creating something new.
Right. They were trying to copy Vanilla Fudge and sound like them. And they came up with their own big sound, gigantic sound, which I think sometimes is overshadowed by Led Zeppelin because and underappreciated some of the stuff Deep Purple did.
We'll be right back with more from Rick Rubin and Jack White.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented 3 new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market, and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at marketmessage2024.com right now. Again, the link to watch is marketmessage2024.com. That's marketmessage2024.com.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
We're back with more from Rick Rubin's conversation with Jack White.
Tell me about the world of music that you were born into. I don't know much about the scene in Detroit when you were a kid. What's it?
Yeah.
Tell me the story.
Well, we had a big family. My brothers liked a lot of rock and roll and, you know, Johnny Cash and Who and Pink Floyd and things like that. A lot of the progressive rock and rock, classic rock and all those stuff. They were really big on all that. And parents were big music lovers of big band music and Nat King Cole and Glenn Miller and Gene Krupa. Yeah, and I was growing up in the inner city Detroit 80s, so that was hip-hop and the Def Jam early records were all being played as we were playing Four Square. It's LL Cool J and that's outside, and Mexican music at the next house over. And the neighbors next door, they all listened, all the boys in their family all listened to like the punky side of things, MC5, Stooges, and that kind of stuff. Our family didn't really listen to that much. I didn't get into that till I was a teenager, older. So yeah, that was kind of lots of different kinds of music going on. But my friends at school didn't listen to any of that stuff. It was only house music and rap and top 40 or whatever.
When did your love of music start?
I think pretty early on. When I started playing drums when I was five, but my brothers had a drum kit up in the attic, so it was easy to go up there and mess around. And they didn't have a drummer. They had a guitar player, bass player, and a keyboard player, as my brothers already, those instruments were already taken. So, you know, drums were obvious for me to play around with. So I did that my whole childhood. I only wanted to play drums growing up. That was it. I used to practice in high school under the desk with my feet, you know, do paradiddles with my feet and with tips of my fingers on my lap during classes. And yeah, it was something I kind of considered that it would be a lifelong obsession along with whatever job I had would be drums and drumming.
And then what was your first music that was your music, not your family's music or what was coming from surrounding you?
Great question. I think there were these trickles of things in high school, which was, there was a punk, you know, got into things like the Cramps and stuff. And it led to this band, the Flat Duo Jets, was a really eye-opener thing. I went to a concert and I thought he really was like a modern Gene Vincent. And that kind of felt like that was my own. And then, but it was also at the same time, there was Rage Against the Machine was happening. And that felt like that was new. That's something my brothers were, you know, maybe are a little bit older and wouldn't have caught on to that in whatever it was, 1992 or something. So there was things like that. They weren't all the same genre. They were different spots. But I think that was kind of nice about when I came up. You know, I could be very much into Bob Dylan and the band and at the same time be into Rage Against the Machine and the Cramps.
What was the first Cramps record you heard? Do you remember?
Oh, it was Human Fly, the song Human Fly.
From Gravest Hits, I think.
Yeah, Gravest Hits.
Yeah, yeah. It was a good one.
Yes. I mean, I still think that might be one of the top 10 recordings ever made.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. That was the first punk rock show I went to. It was
really?
The Cramps at Irving Plaza.
Oh, wow.
When I was in, must have been high school, but might have been junior high school.
Wow.
And it was mind-blowing.
Wow.
Just life-changing.
Who else was on the
bill? The original band. With
Nick Knox.
Nick Knox, the original crew. And Brian Gregory.
Oh, great.
The original guitar player.
Wow.
Yeah. Fantastic. I don't remember who was, I don't even know if there was anyone else on the bill.
Oh.
It was definitely a Cramps gig. There may have been an opening act.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like a bunch of bands.
Right, yeah. My first punk show was Fugazi.
Wow.
And that was another band that was kind of mine. It was great. Nation of Ulysses warmed up. And
where'd you see him play?
It was the Majestic Theater, which I ended up playing in a few years later with the White Stripes. And there's a bowling alley there, and there's a pool hall upstairs. We played the pool hall called the Magic Stick, and then the Majestic Theater as well. So, yeah, it was a cool little hub there, all in the Cass Corridor. And now, you know, it's great because a block away, we've built our Third Man Records pressing plant from that zone. And it's great to still be in that neighborhood creating.
You got to be good if you're playing in a place where there's a bowling alley.
Yeah.
Because... forget it, I'll just go bowling.
Yes, like
if this is no good, I'm bowling.
Exactly.
So everybody likes to bowl.
Yeah.
And the music really has to be good to take you away from bowling.
You're making the perfect point because upstairs as well, the Magic Stick, there was the whole right side was all pool tables. And the left side was the people watching the show. And you could tell by if you were doing something interesting or not about how many people were playing pool.
Yeah.
And how empty the tables were. And yeah, by the time the White Stripes could get going, it was the tables started to empty out. And then we sold enough tickets where they were filling it with people standing there, not playing, watching us. And that felt like, so you're making an interesting point. Yeah.
So when you started playing out in clubs, was there a garage rock scene in Detroit at that time?
Yeah, there was. And I was learning slowly about it. It was a band, or the most important band from then was called the Gorries. They were a three piece, a female drummer named Peg who would only had two toms, no skin on the kick drum. She put her foot in the kick drum to hold it steady, two toms and a tambourine duct taped to the kick drum. That's it. That was the drums. And two guitar players, no bass. Very cool. Black male singer, white female drummer, white male guitar player, no bass, no kick drum. So no bass, no kick drum. And such a unique sound. And they are the kings of the Detroit garage rock scene, still are.
When you were a kid, did you see them play live?
They just had stopped performing when I was old enough to go to shows. I just missed them. And they splintered into these other groups called the Dirt Bombs and Rocket 455. And I saw those bands. And I ended up playing with those bands a couple years later.
Mm-hmm. How old were you at this time when you just started playing?
This is like maybe I'm like 15, 16, starting to just start to learn about playing guitar. And I only did that because the guy I worked in an upholstery shop with, he was a drummer too. So we were both drummers. So in order for us to jam together, I had to play guitar so that we could play together. So we would move the furniture aside and bring out the drum set and get it at the end of the day sometimes. It was pretty amazing experience to have, be an apprentice and also get to play music. I was like, wow, this is great. Great. And then getting into this kind of music too. And this was another band that was my own, you know, that felt like I owned this band.
For sure.
And then we like actually got to meet them. We saw them. I remember seeing Dan Crow in a coffee shop in Detroit. Oh my God, that's Dan from the Gorries.
Yeah.
It's wild because, so you had that whole scene there with that. And then when, by the time I'd come out with doing the White Stripes in that scene, I was a little bit shocked. They embraced us so quickly and things happened. We made a lot of friends pretty fast. I didn't have any friends.
Yeah.
Neither did Meg. And all of a sudden, wait a minute, this guy likes the same music we do. I never had this, you see. Like, I had one friend in high school who plays bass with me still to this day.
Yeah.
He liked, you know, the Deep Purples and the Howlin' Wolf records and stuff that I liked. There was another kid I knew in the next block, and he liked the Beastie Boys, and we bonded a little bit on that. But mostly everybody around me, I went all Mexican grade school, all black high school, they didn't like any of the same music as me. So I wasn't used to like being in a group of lots of people, dozens of people, all like Iggy Pop and all like, you know, this stuff.
Same. I, growing up, same for me.
Yeah.
I was the only punk rocker in my school. It was lonely.
Yeah. It's wild. It's wild. It makes you question it at times, but I was always like, oh, well, I like this. And I kind of almost feel like you should have just loosened up a little bit or made some more friends, you know, if you'd just been a little bit more... I just had such strong beliefs about what turned me on, you know, musically, artistically, and all that stuff.
Do you think because of the Gorries, the idea of having a two-person group felt acceptable?
Yes. The Gorries and the Flat Duo Jets both made acceptable idea that the White Stripes could be a thing.
Interesting.
And then I had come from playing with this Upholsterers group, the two of us playing, and that was just guitar and drums, no bass, which was, you know, say to like my brother's world of music, that was like, whoa, that's weird to have a band with no bass.
Yeah.
But there was already two bands, the Gorries and the Flat Duo Jets both didn't have a bass player.
Like the Doors didn't have a bass player, but they still had four people.
And they had, they still had four people and they still had that.
And when I think of two-person groups before the White Stripes, I think of Suicide, I think of Depeche Mode.
Yeah.
It's always electronic. It's usually organic.
Soft Cell.
Those are all the ones that come to mind.
All those, yes. Yeah. I thought, though, what was different about what we were doing was I had become so immersed and in love with the blues at that point that this would be a great way, an obfuscation for me to be able to play that music and get inside of it and obfuscate with the red, white, and black color scheme and the male-female thing and the no bass player and all that other stuff, which I liked all of that and loved all of it and got a lot out of it. And maybe the blend of that with the blues was what we were. At the moment, I was like, this is my way of sneakily not getting called white boy blues Stratocaster nonsense, which was super uncool in that zone of that garage rock world at the time.
Talk a little bit about the colors. When did the idea of the black, red, and white become part of the vision of the band?
Yeah, my upholstery shop was yellow, black, and white. I all the colors came from my tools and my power saws and my hand tools, upholstery hand tools. And then I had bought a yellow van. It was abandoned, or an old used Detroit Fire Department van. And that's what I was going to do the deliveries from the furniture with. And I started to dress in yellow and black to do the deliveries and then do the bills in crayon and yellow and black crayon. And the artistic side of it took what was taking over. You know.
Did you own that company or were you an employee? Oh, I didn't know that you owned the company.
Yeah, when I was 21, I had a mortgage. I had my own business. I was in three bands.
Wow.
I sometimes wonder, like, people must have thought I was really maybe crazy or insane or something, because now if you saw, like, if you had a 21-year-old son that was doing all that, be like, wow, oh my God, how can I help you? Can I, you know, blah, 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 or pat on the back or whatever. I never heard anything like that from adults saying, oh, that's great you're doing that. Well, that's amazing. Never heard anything like that. And
were they just not paying attention, or what do you think?
Why, I think maybe they just kind of thought, like, he's weird, and he thinks he has a company or something, and he probably doesn't really, or
I don't know. I don't know what they were thinking. Strange.
Most upholstery companies don't have colors associated with them either. Yeah. What do you think triggered that idea?
If I had to pick one moment, there was a moment of... I watched this special on counterfeiting, and they talked about this Dutch designer, and I don't know how to pronounce his name. It's like O.J. Oxenaar. But he had designed this currency, that the 5 and the 10 and the $20 bills. I don't know the name of the currency of there, but it was, you know, this was purple was the 5 and blue was the 10 and red was the 20. And you knew exactly what you had in your hands just by looking at it without looking at the number. And I just really, that was really inspiring to me. Like, oh, instantly to know what something is instantaneously without having to have it written on the screen or written across your T-shirt. So everything I had to do with Third Man upholstery was going to be yellow, black, and white, and center around the number 3 as well.
Third Man was the name of the upholstery company as
Yes, Third Man Upholstery, yeah.
Where did that name come from originally for the upholstery company?
That's a long answer, I was actually the third upholsterer on my street. There was an old guy named Klomp, and then the guy next door to me, Brian Muldoon, and I was the third one. Also, the street was called Ferdinand Street. Third Man. And I was also obsessed with the number 3, and also Orson Welles was my biggest idol at that moment, especially. Yeah. So all of this came around, Third Man. Yeah, your furniture is not dead was the on my business card,
Great.
Was the slogan, which now with Third Man Records, it's your turntable's not dead. And
wow.
So, yeah.
So you basically keep retreading the same old tired ideas from childhood.
Oh, yeah. It never goes away.
That's great.
Yeah. So that got transferred over to the White Stripes, which was instead of yellow, black, and white, it was red, black, and white.
And how did that decision get made? How did it become red, black, and white?
Meg said something about peppermint candies. I love peppermint candies. Yeah. And we were at the drugstore. I said, oh, you know, that we've been playing this music. That should be on your bass drum, that peppermint. You should just paint it. I said, I'll paint it when we get home. I'll paint the peppermint on your bass drum. That'll be funny. And then once we did that, and the drum set was white, and I thought, and she had black hair, and I had black hair. And I'm like, oh, wow. Then I think maybe this is the 3 colors. Instead of I have a Third Man with yellow, black, and white, this would be red, black, and white.
Yeah.
For some reason, people missed the black part of it a lot. People always just say, oh, everything I do is red and white, or whatever. So whatever. I don't care. But it was actually supposed to be 3 colors.
Yeah. Actually, we thought of it as black and white with red.
Yeah. Okay,
just because black and white, it always felt monochromatic.
Yes. And now all of my solo albums are all blue, white, and black. Mm. And, you know, white's all colors and black is the absence of color. Mm-hmm. And so he really is only one color for each of these things, red or blue, yellow, the Third Man.
When did you decide to start the label?
That was sort of an accident when our manager, Ian Montone, had gotten us. We were getting like this bidding war had started with the band. Probably because we stupidly didn't take the first offers that came to us, which were really generous. And we probably should have just, yes, right away, sir. We're coming up with an album right away. And we didn't. We kind of thought, I kept thinking, nobody's going to like this band in the mainstream 6 months from now. This will sign with these guys. They'll put out one record and they'll drop us next year.
And that might have been right.
Yeah.
That actually might have been right.
Might have been.
Yeah.
So that was... my either very smart or very ignorant way of looking at the time, which led to a bidding war. And then at that point, it was sort of, we could almost ask for whatever we wanted at that second, which was very strange because I'm like, well, what do you want? I don't know. I knew I didn't want to owe anybody anything. So I didn't take any big advances. I just said, well, I want us to get paid for the records we sold.
Yes.
So that's on up and up. I don't owe anybody any favors or anything like that. I still feel that way today. And, it worked out, and Ian got us our own label to sort of protect me and protect us, and you know, this imprint label name of, well, what are you going to call it? I said, oh, well, Third Man Records. And that became, we licensed these people records from my label, Third Man Records. So that was Ian's idea at the time as a protective insurance thing.
How did Ian see you guys first?
Man, how did Ian see us? We would talk to somebody at Sub Pop named Craig Aronson. I think he's no longer... with us, I think. He started asking questions, which every label probably would or should. You guys ever think about getting a bass player and stuff like that? And we thought, see, here we go, you know? This is what we've always heard. They're going to try to change us into a regular band or something. And we didn't get mad or anything. We just thought, maybe it's not for us. And then we would sit the next day and think, oh, God, are we so spoiled that we're going to have an attitude about a really nice opportunity? Like, so what? Maybe we should get a bass player if it means we get to make records and not have day jobs anymore. I don't know. So we go back and forth.
Did you like the sound, though? Like, did you already know the sound of the two-person group that you guys had, what you were making, mm-hmm. felt special to you?
It definitely felt special and felt right yeah. and felt good.
Yes.
If someone comes in the room and says, well, we're going to try to take this to the mainstream.
Yeah, yeah.
I would have said, that's not going to work.
Right.
I'm not going to pretend like I know everything about music yeah. or the music business, but my vote would be, I wouldn't bet on that.
Right.
And it still shocks me
yeah.
that connected with people.
I
remember coming home and then watching my nieces and nephews watching our video of ours on MTV in the living room and thinking, this is not making any sense.
Yeah,
it doesn't add up. It's like, it's almost like, we kind of started justifying it by saying, you know what? Maybe it's like why The Simpsons is so good, but it's also really popular. Maybe it's like that. I'm like, no, it couldn't be. You know, or what? You know what I mean? Sometimes you just assume when you get into, like, especially in the hipster world, I get into really amazing deep records that nobody's ever heard of. You start assuming good things are ignored and things that aren't very good are popular. You start getting into that rut, which is not really true. But you get into that rut, especially when you're younger. So it was confusing for us because we thought, does this mean we're not any good? If we're getting well known, like, maybe that means we're no good. Or what we thought was special is not special.
Also interesting that not only were there really no known two-person rock bands in the world at that time,
yeah, yeah.
there weren't even that many three-man, you know, other
no,
than like
not many
there
trios
was
either,
there
yeah.
was especially after Jimi Hendrix, like Jimi Hendrix, you'd think broke open the world and Cream.
Yeah,
and
but
then
after that, maybe the police, that's
maybe,
about it. Yeah, there's not very many.
It's funny.
It's bizarre. It should be hundreds.
You'd think.
Yeah. And then we saw that was maybe what started to bring us around. And then in the subsequent couple years after White Blood Cells came out, there were several two-piece bands that had become signed to major labels, with The Kills and the Fiery Furnaces or yada, 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 all down the line. And we kept seeing that, oh, I say, okay, so this is now...
It's a thing.
I guess we proved something to somebody. We weren't trying to prove,
yeah.
really, but it proved something to somebody that maybe this is a path we could explore some more. And it was great because a lot of great music came out of that.
And do you know if any of those bands existed before they heard the White Stripes? I'm going to bet they did. I don't know if they all did.
I'm
going to
bet
they did because there's something interesting that happens when there's a movement, which you're part of a movement.
Mm-hmm.
That it doesn't just happen one, like it's not one leader and everybody follows.
Yeah.
It's like the time is right for this for some reason.
Yeah, there's other people in other bedrooms and garages doing similar stuff.
Yes.
And now they have a chance to have some attention paid to them and brought out into the daylight. And if something new that comes out that's novel, you will see maybe people will rush to find other things like it that are also legit. And they might be. And then there definitely will be a second wave of copycat. And sometimes the copycat second wave is 10 times more successful than the first wave.
Often.
Yeah.
Often.
And then sometimes you see a little bit of copycat happen, and then that copycat morphs into something else. I remember when I first saw the Arctic Monkeys come on, I thought, wow, that guy's moving around like the guitar player in The Strokes.
Yep.
Like he's walking around, he's holding his guitar high,
yep.
The Strat high, like Albert in The Strokes.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, that's great. I mean, they're just kids, you know, they're like, I don't know what they were, 19 or something. I was like, that's fine. And then look, the Arctic Monkeys morphed into their own thing, you know, very quickly. And their lyrics were so unique on their own. And there's nothing wrong to have that folk process of being inspired and trying to take it to another level and emulating people you're interested
in. I think everyone goes through that of like, it's the you have to start somewhere to end up finding your own voice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Any way in is good.
Yeah, I think so. If you can get in at all,
exactly. Yeah. It seems like if you're inspired to make music, you're inspired to make it by someone.
Yeah.
And the first method when you're a kid is, well, I'm going to play it like that. Like that seems obvious. That's the starting of it. And then it turns into whatever it's going to turn into.
If you were Dylan coming up and you liked rock and roll in the 50s and the folk movement happened and that inspired you and he got it seems to get really engrossed in that and abandons the more rock and roll side of him and embraces the folk side of him and gets very into these deep older Blind and Lemon Jefferson songs and all this kind of stuff and becomes the new king of folk and changes the world subsequently. He doesn't lose that love of rock and roll. It's still in there. And it does eventually come back around a few years later.
I don't think you could ever suppress something like that if that was inside of you. That's the first taste of something. The first things I really liked, the Deep Purples and Led Zeppelins, are going to be with me forever. It doesn't matter how, whatever bizarre punk band or strange thing I get into, that's still going to be down in there somewhere. And sometimes people will say, oh, I can hear that. That sounds like a Smoke on the Water, or sounds like a, you know, like, ah, I don't doubt it. You know, I don't doubt it. I don't run to try to copy that stuff.
Of course.
But I don't run away from it either and try to pretend that I don't like it or it's not part of me. But I've never sat down and tried to copy someone else's thing on purpose. I'm going to do that because that worked for them, so I'm going to copy that and steal that.
Yeah,
I've never had that devious mustache twiddling thought in my mind of that.
Yeah.
I was like, no, these are things I like and I'll do my own thing. I'll try to do my own thing. And there's going to be moments where people say, oh, that sounds like that. And that sounds like that. I'm like, okay, well, you can't live in a vacuum anyway. You're already playing an instrument and singing with your own vocal cords. I mean, someone's going to say you sound like something. So don't worry about that. But let's just try to dive forward.
What were the blues things? You said at the beginning of the band, you were really deeply into the blues.
Yeah.
What was the blues at the time that was really speaking to you?
Sunhouse and Robert Johnson and Howlin' Wolf and Charlie Patton. I was just getting into Charlie Patton, slightly into it, but it was hard for me to understand it. But I felt like that was something that felt real. It wasn't polished. And that's the same old story I suppose people have always said about the blues when they sort of discover it. But then what's kind of interesting about my time period of embracing that is I got to instantly say, oh, okay, that's why Led Zeppelin and then the Yardbirds and Jeff Beck and those guys were feeding off that record, and them with Van Morrison, they were listening to that blues record. Okay, so these guys resold the blues back to America from England. Got it. And then Jimi Hendrix comes over to England from America, black, and also plays blues and sells that back to America. And you just start making all that, all those combinations. Yeah. Like, okay, great. Yeah. Well, I guess I'm in good company then because I feel the exact same way. Maybe 30 years has passed, but I feel
but
like I'm almost the same.
Again.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
maybe it was, it was time for it to be reevaluated or rediscovered in a way.
When you guys were first exploding, I'll say, what were the other things that would have been on the radio at the same time that you were on the radio?
Oh, so like, say, what was like on alternative radio
station
like
what,
at the
what
time?
Would have been played before you and after you?
I remember now. I think it was the Limp Bizkits and the Nu Metal.
I see.
Korn and things. I think that's what was happening. Late 90s, early 2000s. I think that's what was going on. Well, I had listened to alternative radio in the early 90s, when I was in high school then.
Yeah.
So that was, Nirvana and Pearl Jam and all that stuff and Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah.
So I had all those records and listened to all that stuff. I almost never mentioned that when I talk like this either, which is, it's kind of funny. I mean, that was actually a big part of my high school was those bands.
And I
sat listening to those albums with
headphones. Well, if you like rock music.
You're going to.
You have to. You have to if you're a kid.
Right.
That would be the rock music of the day when you're growing up.
Exactly, yeah. It seemed like, in 1990, if you said the Beatles did something in 1969, that seemed like it was 50 years ago. It was only 20 years.
I know, it's unbelievable.
That's like talking right now about the White Stripes records in 2001.
I know.
That seemed like it was 5 years ago.
Yes.
I don't know why time is so different seeming.
I think as you get older, time speeds up.
Yeah.
And when we're kids, if a year seems like an eternity.
Yeah.
And now the years just fly by.
Right. Yeah. They just fly by.
Yeah, we have a visitor. I didn't know he was sitting outside.
Yeah.
Come on in. Hey, what's going on?
Hey, man.
Make yourself comfy.
Neil.
Man, how are you, buddy?
So good to see you.
Wow. You look great.
You look great, too.
Yeah, man.
God bless. Wow. Yeah.
When we come back, we'll have more from Rick Rubin, Jack White, and Neil Young. Plus a special rendition of Jack's new song, A Tip From You to Me.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented 3 new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn of the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. He put everything you need to know in a new presentation specifically designed for people off Wall Street. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at newstocktrend.com right now. Again, the link to watch is newstocktrend.com. That's newstocktrend.com.
We're back with the rest of Rick Rubin's conversation with Jack White and their surprise visit from Neil Young at Shangri-La.
How cool to see you here.
Well, I heard you were here.
Sit in the middle.
Rick told me you were here. And, yeah.
Oh, man.
So here we are.
Cool.
That's great. So you've been recording
out there having a beer.
Oh, nice.
With you guys. Kind of doing some stuff, you know?
Excellent. How's it been going here?
It's great.
Yeah?
We finished... it took us 3 weeks.
Something like that.
Yeah.
I saw the trailer for the Crazy Horse barn movie. That looks cool.
Oh, we had a good time doing it.
Yeah. It's great.
Daryl made a movie about it. It's fun. It's just great. I mean, shit.
Yeah.
The youngest guy in the band is 70. Okay.
Man.
It was fantastic. We had a great time.
I've been putting out an album recently, so everyone keeps asking, these questions about where are things going to be for you, when you're, 60 years old and 80 years old. And I just keep saying, it's really nice. It's a nice position to be in to have, Bob and Neil and Tom Waits have already proven there's these things that can happen and can continue.
Yeah.
Because I remember... when I was 12 and the Rolling Stones were 40 and everyone's like, oh my God, how much longer could they go on? Yeah. And it's so nice that you guys are able to sort of prove that. What do you think, Rick? What's your opinion about hip hop guys when they're 80?
You never know. People like hearing the songs.
Exactly.
They'll be doing something.
Yeah.
If they got the spirit, they'll be cranking something out.
Yeah, exactly.
Because,
yeah.
What else can we do when you get right down to it?
Yeah.
There's really nothing. Everything else is fun, a little relief here and there.
Exactly.
But the real deal is to make the music, however you make it.
Absolutely.
But we had a good time. We were in here and had a great time for 3 weeks.
Oh, that's great, man. That's great.
Yeah, I feel good about it.
Yeah.
Did you play acoustic, electric, both, or was like...
I played a little electric. I played electric on two songs.
Oh, great.
And everything else I played unheard of combinations of instruments.
Oh, great.
Just,
nice. I've
become a kind of a funk pipe, pump organ.
Oh, yeah.
Funk pump organ?
Yes. Or pump funk.
Pump funk.
That's what they'll be doing, pump funk.
That's it. So that, and you combine that with a marine band, through an octave divider into a little deluxe.
Oh.
And combine that with the pump funk thing happening.
Oh, nice.
It's cool.
Oh,
it's
good. Great.
We can play your stuff if you'd like to hear.
I'd love to.
Yeah, then when we capture you like that, you've got a commitment to make.
Well,
it could be music.
It's up to you. But if you want to hear it, you can hear it.
Oh, yeah.
It's fresh.
It was a fun experience and different than... Certainly for me, different than any that I've ever been involved in.
Nice.
Yeah, and inspiring.
Great. It's a good vibe here, too.
Yeah, it's great. Just started off with always taking a walk in the woods up in Colorado, in the wintertime. And I was walking along whistling, and I heard this. I said, that's the same song I was whistling yesterday. I don't know what it is. So I got out my flip phone and recorded it.
Yeah.
Once I'd done that, the next day I walked out, I'm whistling a whole new song.
Oh, my God.
And I did it day after day after day till I had 10 different melodies with no instruments, just...
Yeah. That's great.
So cool, going through the trees and singing into this old, whatever it was, black thing.
Yeah.
And then I put it on my computer and I listened to them all and said, well, that's that melody, this is that melody, this is that day and everything, because I didn't organize it.
Yeah.
So I got it in there, and then I put them all, and I listened to them, and I said, shit, might be something here.
Yeah.
They're all here. They came, all these melodies.
where did this shit come from, man?
I'm telling you, man.
It's
that's
like
the question.
Antennas. It's like antennas, and if you're lucky to have a little tiny, little silver antenna for a minute in your life to just pick up a frequency like that, yeah, you know?
Amazing.
We're all
tuned, magic.
You know, all we have to do is be there.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't ever ignore it for a second.
Yeah.
You come, you're there.
That's
yeah, that's
right.
Your boss.
That's yeah. True. Yeah.
That's the muse. You gotta yeah. Go with it.
And it goes fast.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
If you don't catch it, it's gone.
You know, and it's gone.
Yeah.
Too.
There's, you know, so many times where you woke up in the middle of the night and played something, and I'll remember that. Go back to sleep. I'll remember that. And nope.
Never happens.
No, yeah. You got to jot. You yeah. Got to do something. You know, some kind of sound.
Yes.
Yeah. So I did that, and I wrote. I had this combination and stuff, and I was listening to it on the computer, and it was like not this last moon, but the moon before that, right on the moon. I wrote 8 songs in 2 days.
Oh, great.
All the lyrics going crazy. And it was cool. And I ended up looking at them on the computer, which I, after I spell corrected everything, which is a mess, and I did it. And then, and I haven't changed a fucking word.
Oh, great.
Or a punctuation mark or anything.
Oh, great. Oh, that's
so it was like a direct shot. It just came. I had no idea what was going on.
That's a good sign already. Yeah, without hearing any of it. That's a good sign. I was going to send you this track the other day. I just got the mix done recently. This song I thought maybe you'd like. It's going to be on this record I'm putting out. Can I play you a second of it?
Yeah.
Ask yourself if you are happy, and then you cease to be. That's a tip from you to me, and it's worked for sure. I don't ask myself for nothing anymore. My peace is freedom from the masses, 'cause the masses cannot see. That's a tip from them to me. And now I know for sure I don't need nobody's help now anymore. Oh, will I be alone tonight? Oh, I don't know. He goes, someone seems to know the truth about the things he used to do. And that's hard for you. It's so hard to be the one who knows it's true. Walking through the park, my fingers clenching tight. Then I notice that I'm all alone tonight. And it's hard to tell for sure if I even need to think now anymore. Alone tonight. Oh, I don't know. Oh, will love leave me alone tonight? Oh, I don't know.
Cool. How'd you write it?
Thanks.
How'd it come to pass?
This was as a quote, John Stuart Mill, I said, ask yourself if you're happy and then you cease to be. So I just said that, you know, ask yourself if you are happy and then you'll cease to be. And I was just staying there, and then I just... ask yourself if you are happy and then you will cease to be. That's when those moments come where you're like, oh, thanks, that happened. Thank God that happened. And now you can... The rest is easier. Like, yeah.
Cool.
That's great, man.
It reminded me of some of your things in the past, too. So I thought I was going to send that to you. I'll send it to you when I get home. When I get back. I love, you know, a love of yours, besides the record we did in the booth the other
was
a mess, cool? And that was the best. That was the best.
That was a fun record.
Oh, man.
What a concept. We did a great record in Jack's booth where you go and be in a fair or something, you put 10 cents in or something and or a quarter or whatever and record a record to your girlfriend and send it to her. Whatever, your mom or whoever. That was really cool.
It's direct to vinyl?
Direct to vinyl in the booth.
And then you send the vinyl to somebody.
Yeah, you can mail it to them. It's funny, we had somebody in the third man shop a few weeks back, and they were saying, and we were showing them the booth. We're like, yeah, so you can record a record in this booth. And goes, oh, wow, that's cool. And you know what? Now that I think of it, I saw Neil Young messing around with one of these on TV once. This is the booth.
Yeah, funny.
Is it, dude? Yeah.
This is great, man. But what I was going to say is that track you did, the Oh Susanna, the version of Oh Susanna you did. I love that, man. That really was something.
Yeah.
It's got a whole vibe to it.
Doesn't it? You know who did that originally? Was the Thorns.
Oh, really?
Remember them?
No.
Remember Tim Rose?
Okay, yeah, Tim Rose. Joe? Yeah.
So the group that he was from was called the Thorns.
The Thorns, okay.
He was just part of the Thorns.
Okay.
And the Thorns did folk rock things. So they took classics like that. And they did that arrangement. I heard that and I went,
oh, wow,
the fucking greatest shit.
Oh, I gotta go check that out now, yeah.
Yeah, the Thorns, check them out. Great. They got a lot, you know, and then I did Come Around the Mountain When She Comes and all this. I just kept going.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
A fun thing to do.
Yeah,
I had fun with that. That was great.
There was those wild moments in those 60s folk bands, the Fairport conventions and the, you know, all the different ones that were trying to, like, find a little zone. But sometimes they were doing this novelty, like old, John Brown would hit the hammer and the blah, 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 and then whatever, Hammer in the Morning and all that stuff and working into like a rock pop song or whatever. But then there's novelty of songs. And then there's ones that actually crack through that while they actually stumbled on something amazing right there, like synthesizing two different genres.
Cool,
that must have been wild, like when you, because you were there with that, with Buffalo Springfield and those early moments of people embracing country and rock and roll and blending them together.
Was it clear that the folk revival was a revival at the time?
No, it was just folk music.
It was just folk.
It wasn't a revival because folk music never really goes anywhere. It is.
Yeah.
It's not here and then gone and back.
Right.
It's just always here. It just depends on if you want to go there. Everybody kind of went there, and then the rock thing was happening, folk and rock. And it was a happening time. You could do a lot of stuff. It was cool. It was cool to be able to, you know, I would go and play a little club, and then I'd read about how I was cliche-ridden. I'm going, I'm in the paper,
cliche-ridden.
Did you know about his band that he was in with the Rick James for a minute?
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that great?
Incredible.
That was wild stuff.
Incredible.
I lived with Rick.
Amazing.
He had an apartment in on the street just off of Yonge Street in Toronto. Amazing. What a character. We had a great time.
That's what I'm referring to earlier. Those are those moments where, like, people are trying to put something together that maybe has, like, a whole false, fake idea or a shitty producer behind it or some guy is like a money guy or something, but there's these amazing moments that could have turned into the greatest band of all time. Who knows
That's right. It was on its way, and we we tried, we did what we could. We got busted for
was it draft
tax evasion
or something?
And then our manager OD'd. He was on heroin, he OD'd. So
what happened
really
next? How long was that period after that finished where you were like, didn't know what to do next?
3 months or so before Springfield, you know, we thought Bruce Palmer and I from the Minor Birds went south. Still going south.
Minor Birds flew south.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Should we play?
Could I? Yeah. I'd love to hear.
Let's play. You up for an entire experience?
Of course, yeah.
Why not? Let's replay you.
Man, wow.
What a trip, huh?
For real. Congrats.
Thanks.
Great songs and great tones, and the vibe is great, and it's really
It's different,
this,
isn't it? Like, it sounds, it sounds obviously like him, but
yeah,
the songs are different. Yeah, but I think it's because the way they were written.
Yeah, it has that. It has a feeling like you had a melody, like you're talking about. If you hadn't said that, I would say maybe you had melodies first, and then added and later to them.
Right.
So it makes sense.
Nice. Yeah, what a trip.
Yeah. It must be nice to have a band of guys like that. You can just keep coming around long.
That's the groove.
Yeah.
You know, they're there.
Yeah, you're lucky. That's really great to have.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I count myself very lucky with Crazy Horse.
Awesome.
You know, Ralph and Billy and Nils, it's great.
Awesome.
They really can't help but sound like themselves.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like
yeah.
It's completely their trip.
Yeah,
they're great.
They are great.
It's amazing stuff.
What is that echo on the guitar? What is it?
It's an Echoplex.
Echoplex.
And
okay.
Also, every once in a while, an analog MXR analog delay.
Okay, yeah.
Every once in a while.
Yeah.
Mostly the Echoplex.
Oh, great.
But I got four different settings for it. With how much echo.
The sliding bar?
Yeah, but it's a foot thing. Oh, wait.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the volume of the effects that I have four levels on. It's just a lot of stuff.
Well, how loud the echo is.
Yeah, how loud it goes.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of fun with that.
Yeah.
Shit. Yeah. Oh, yeah, baby.
Nice. How long is that last track? That's the album closer. Yeah.
13 minutes. Nice.
Something like that.
Great.
Something like that.
Great.
Yeah.
You guys continue on.
Cool.
It's cool.
Good vibe though, no?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's really nice. It's just I'm just devastated like how clean and clear his voice is.
Yeah.
And how at times I wish I feel like I can't get as clean as I was when I was in my 20s.
Yeah.
At times and trying to. I worked with Tom Jones on one little 45 once, and he had. Gave me that same vibe, which is like, man, it's almost like there's like a water faucet in the back of your throat cleaning off these vocal
cords.
Tom
Jones's voice is unbelievable.
It's creamy good.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, people take it for granted, I think.
Yeah.
It's pretty impressive, especially in person.
Absolutely.
That's how he sounds like he's 25 years old there.
Yeah.
It's, I'm vocally on that, you know, so clean. And I've been trying to get into that lately more often too, like finding some songs where I can hold notes longer and exemplify them more. I always feel like I'm not a singer, like just a vocalist.
Oh,
just,
you're a singer. You got to do that.
Thank you. Yeah, it's just,
you that. Go for the long one. Go
yeah,
longer
yeah.
Longer than you thought.
Okay, yeah.
Or just go.
Yeah.
Because that'd be a new area.
Right, right.
Who knows what's at the other end of the note.
Right.
You could definitely go there.
There's also something cool about when you're pushing the boundaries of your ability. That sounds really interesting. Mm. Like when you can, like when you sing something that you can't really sing, you
yeah,
can
when you're
almost
reaching
sing
for
it,
yeah.
And you don't really make it, but yeah. there's a honesty in that.
Yeah.
That just feels good.
I think that's why I like the band's background vocals.
Yeah.
They seem like they always be
they're
reaching for notes
for
that they can't really hit.
Right.
And it's, yeah, it's great. It's just great. The attempt, you can hear the attempt and you give it a grace. You allow it. You don't really need it to actually successfully hit that note. Or maybe they go past it, like Neil said. But there's a beauty to it, right?
And if we listen, you know, to the old records that we love, there's a lot of stuff that's out of tune and out of time.
Oh, God, yes.
All the time.
Oh, God,
all
yes.
All the time.
Yes. Well, like, my favorite Neil vocal is, Tonight's the Night, that tone.
That's great.
And then, he's tired of me asking, what mic and he used and what was going on when we were working before together. And it's... You know, whatever circumstances around that, the recording in the room, or whatever. Yeah. There's mistakes. There's feedback. There's all that. But who cares? Nobody cares.
Feeling, yeah.
Yeah, the feelings in there. It's
well, it's great to see you, Jack. I'm gonna take off.
So great to see you too.
What a
great surprise!
Great.
This like, woke up this morning. I didn't think I was gonna be seeing you.
How good is this?
Yeah, it's great.
Well, good luck, man.
Thank you.
See you later, sir.
I'll be around.
Have fun. I'll probably see you in a couple of days.
Yeah. See ya. Looking good, man. Sounding good.
Thank you.
Great.
You too.
All right.
All right, now.
Later, man. That was a nice treat.
Yeah. Those are the... It's something funny. There's something funny about, like, I think people said, when you're... like when you can afford it, all of a sudden they start giving you free jeans and stuff like that. When they didn't give it to you when you couldn't afford it. That's when you needed the free jeans.
Yeah.
It's something funny about that. Like when you get into like I mean, to make it short, like show business or yeah. something. You know, I think I was going to see you or Neil today. I woke up.
Yeah.
And here we are. And the other day I was in Vegas, and next door to my room, Bill Burr, the comedian, is Incredible. Next door. If I was just a regular Joe Schmo still doing upholstery, Bill Burr wouldn't be next to me in the hotel room. You know what I mean?
It's a trip. There's
something about like, you manifest to the universe, and somehow it just kind of makes out.
It's
you bump into somebody out of a crowd of 50,000 people. You bump into the one person you were supposed to bump into. And you're like, so how could cool. that happen?
So cool.
It's amazing. It's like the thing to really hold on to, like to stay positive about it. You know?
Yeah.
Because I also think that we manifest our fears. You know, we put out what we're afraid of, and they happen. We
yes.
make them happen because
yes, yes.
we stress on them so much.
You know, our thoughts really have tremendous power.
Yeah. Well, that's great, man. I'm glad you guys played that for me. That's a nice treat.
Yeah. Tell me about how your approach to making music from the beginning to now, how has it changed over the course of your life?
Some of the stuff is I'm still making it as hard on myself as possible, as I've always done, you know, trying to not take the easy way out. And, you know, sitting in there, when I start feeling like it's going well, I'll either consciously or subconsciously, I'll throw a monkey wrench in the works and make it more difficult. I'm playing a bass part. Oh, I've never played fretless bass. Let's try that. That'll be harder. And it is harder. And then, you know, you try it. And then now I'm in a place. Now I'm, if it's good, I can be proud of it because I know that it was a more difficult challenge than it was to take the easier way out. So I still do that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And some stuff you realize, like these records I just made recently, that you get in there and you're like, oh, wow, okay. I knew how to get that kick drum sound, and we did it. And I bought that microphone, and I own the studio, and we made it. And I bought the studio and bought that microphone so I could make that sound.
Yeah.
And there I did it. Wow, I actually did it. That whole thing worked.
Yeah.
And it's because I learned that mic works in 1998, and then in 2012, I learned that compressor worked. And thankfully, those things, you can hold on to those and you remember them, and they actually can work on a functional level. Like a carpenter would say, yeah, that's the right saw, chop saw for the 2x4, table saw for the plywood, whatever. These perfunctory things. And that applies to, compression and EQ and these kind of things. Stuff I could care less about in the 90s and early 2000s. I didn't care about any. I don't want to know the name of that microphone. I don't even want. I like the shape of it. Don't even tell me the name. I used to be very much about that. But luckily, over time, I've held on to those, and they actually do work. So you feel, okay, that's good. At least, if the songs are, is there a moment where there's no songs there, or I'm trying and nothing's coming out, at least I have some sort of workmanlike hardware store, workmanlike things that I can accomplish to set the table.
Mm-hmm. You know? Anything different on more philosophically or conceptually that's different than when you were young?
Philosophically, well, the one sad negative thing I don't like about sort of writing songs when you're more well-known to people rather than when you're just by yourself in an attic or garage is that I at times will give up on a line or a title because I don't want to have to talk about it. I don't want to have to answer questions about it. I don't want to have it, they're going to assume I'm talking about myself, or they're going to assume I'm talking about my girlfriend or my ex-wife or something like that.
I see.
And it's like, even though I'm not writing like that, they might think that, well, it's not even worth it. Just scratch it off and write something else. And that's a shame because I shouldn't do that I shouldn't have to do that. But it's just picking your battles. So that's different from when I was younger.
That's interesting. Since it's a shame,
we'll
right now we have this opportunity. I am going to give you permission going forward that anything that you write that you like, you can say it without ever worrying about having to talk about it.
Thank you.
I give you that permission.
Thank you.
Yeah. And you can do it. Problem solved.
Exactly. That's all I do.
It's amazing because it really is. It's like these things, these boundaries we put up for ourselves, they really are mindsets.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Society goes through different phases too. There's things people are sensitive about right now that they were not sensitive about 10 years ago, and things 5 years from now that we don't know are going to happen. And as we all know, but if you're lucky enough to be sharing with enough people that it's a topic of possible conversation to interpret the new Neil Young record and how it relates to Earth and how what he might be saying, what message he's trying to say. if you're lucky enough that people find a relevance in what you're doing, mm-hmm. part of you owes it to be able to stand behind what you're trying to put out in the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've never been a big fan of people who are like, yeah, I don't know what that means. Whatever.
Yeah.
I don't care. That's a little too easy, like, for me. I'm not saying that good art doesn't come from writing abstract things, you know.
Do you always know what it means?
I always have hopes, I think. I think I can see where I was thinking of this character and what mm-hmm. I was attempting him to try to figure out, or him or her. Mm-hmm. And then I have hopes that this word can be taken three different ways. Mm-hmm. And I hope maybe people take multiple paths with it, and multiple different people take different paths with it. Never been excited about this is what it means and this is what I want you to think it means. Right. And that's why I'm not the biggest fan of, like, sort of a lot of modern singer-songwriter is, this is about me and my boyfriend breaking up, or me and my girlfriend breaking up, and I want you to know about it. And when you sing it, think of me breaking up with my boyfriend. Yeah. I mean, why would I want to put you through that? You know, I mean, why should you relive my thing? It's better to, for me, it's better to find some kind of neutral zone where these are characters that multiple people can get multiple ideas from, rather than one thing etched in stone.
Were lyrics important to you from the beginning?
Yes, yeah.
As a fan, before you made music, the lyrics as well as the music always from the beginning?
Yes, and, you know, I remember even being a young kid and getting, you know, sometimes you would be hopeful that something had deeper meaning, and grew up thinking, oh, that has such a deeper meaning, and then finding out an article later, like, oh no, that was just a Little Richard song we copied or something like that. Yeah. And you're like, oh, well, okay, I still got some meaning out of it. And maybe that's kind of what I'm just saying right now. Yeah. Like, your hope is that people will get deeper meaning on their own if they can, you know, if it succeeds in some way.
I feel like there's and tell me if this is right, there's always a traditional theme running through your work where it's like, feels like it always has historical roots.
Mm.
Is that, would you say that that's, it, first of all, is it accurate from your perspective? And if so, is it on purpose, or is it just by loving so much music over the course of your life that it happens that way?
That's a compliment, you know, that you just gave me, and it's a compliment even if it wasn't true, I think. It's a compliment to feel that
way. That's how I hear it. I hear it as there's always some, it's got roots, and I love roots music. I love where it comes from.
Well, there's an interesting thing about that. I mean, a lot of the, you know, like coming up in different rock and roll wars, and you talk to other contemporaries and stuff they're working on, and a lot of artists and writers and guitar players and drummers and stuff, they don't have much depth in their history or love of music or anything. And so what? Who cares?
Yeah.
And then there's people that do. And then there's guys who are like, you know, super nerdy and obscure and go way too deep, you know, and have lost the beauty of music through the minutia of it, you know. Mm-hmm. I've always tried to keep, you know, one foot in and out of that world if I can. Mm-hmm. I like to know a little bit about amplifiers, but not how to fix them. I like to know a little bit about this genre of music, but not enough where it swallows me up and I become obsessed with only that. And it gets me the ability to do this and that. Even engineering and production and stuff, I try not to really get too hands-on, because I know how I am. I could get in there and become a knob jockey guy who all he does is worry about the levels of compression and stuff, rather than keeping half of my brain in the world being able to create in songs and write and perform them and all that stuff. And it's been a pretty good balance. I've kept a pretty good balance over the years of trying not to get too involved in one aspect of it. I get jealous at times when you see people like, oh, wow, he's just a guitar player. Oh, yeah, that would be nice. Or that's just a producer or just a singer. Even the word just, it sounds like it's an insult, but it's not to me. It's like, I'm jealous of it, because it's like, wow, it'd be great. You could just concentrate on that one thing.
Yeah. You could get really, really good at that.
Yeah.
You know, if that's your,
yeah,
if you did one thing.
But at the end of the day, I'm lucky that my brain wants to be active in these different spots. And so I'm happy about it. I feel good about it.
When did you buy the pressing plant or the record press?
Yeah, I started building that in, like, I think 2015. And then I think it opened in 2016. And it's wild. It's great. And then there was times where I'm like, oh, I shouldn't have done that. This is a lot of work and a lot of, like, boring economic and, you know, making widgets at a factory work and having lots of employees and insurance and all those things that are not that interesting.
Tell me about the space. The space, and do you have, how many machines do you have?
Yeah, I don't know the square footage, but it's pretty giant. It used to be like a parking structure. It used to be where they made Willie's Jeeps. It was like a Willie's Jeeps kind of little assembly place. And we have 8 manual machines, and I think now coming up on 6 automatic presses. And we can do about between 5,000 and 8,000 records a day.
Incredible. There,
which is great, yeah.
Incredible.
And the wait period now is, you know, 8 to 10 months for vinyl in the vinyl industry.
Yeah.
So, you know, Third Man had a lot to do with this vinyl resurgence, making this come to this fruition like this. And right now we're in the mode of, you know, sort of this year has been, this last couple of years are like the Taylor Swifts and Paul McCartney's, you know, putting out multiple variants of a record. And it's just amazing because it's just great. It's turning on yet another generation of kids and teenagers onto this physical format.
Are the machines old machines?
No, they're all brand new.
And they still, they're still being made.
When we opened the plant, there were no companies making new vinyl presses. And in the first year we opened and started, and we were about to start, a couple of companies started up around the world, in Europe and in Canada. And now there are several. Now there's 5, I think, making presses.
Where are all of the old machines? Did they get scrapped?
That was the problem. Like, we were about to open a plant, and then the only way you can put presses in was to buy old presses from somebody else.
Yeah.
And they're hard to come by, like houndsteeth. Like, usually other giant plants would buy them up if they came available, because, you know, you're not going to see it again.
Yeah. So is it similar to like buying an old mixing desk?
Not as peaceful as the mixing desk, where you could actually find a few guys to really know how to fix it. It's such a small group of people that know how to work on them. But, you know, there's machinists who can work on any kind of machine and stuff. There's those guys.
But there was a time when there were many, many of these machines.
Oh, my God, yes, yeah.
So what happened to those?
Great question. I think they were junked.
Wow.
You know, it's so wild because you can never get a square answer about this stuff. I was talking to Martin Scorsese recently about the Technicolor machines.
Yeah.
Well, what happened to all those Technicolor machines? And he said that they got sold to China and they weren't being used anymore anywhere else, but they were still being used in the film industry in China. So a lot of them went there. But I think a lot of them just get junked. We had I had a talk with Martin Mills, who runs Beggar's Banquet label in Europe, and he was telling me this interesting thing, because we were saying, we have to wait, you know, 8 months now if we want to, even at my own plants, I got to get in line, which is crazy. And he said, what we'd have in Britain is, you know, we put out a single, and by Tuesday we would get that chart number, and if it was in a top 20, if you had a song in the top 20, like he had with Gary Newman and Cars and Our Friends Electric and stuff, then you could get on Top of the Pops. But that meant you had to have, they would call in an order of 25,000 7 inches that had to be in the stores by Friday morning for the weekend sales. So in 2 days' time, they could press 25,000 records and have them in stores with record sleeves.
Wow.
Unimaginable at this moment in time.
Yes.
Even if there was not a humongous demand, that would be very hard to pull off. But they had just so many presses and so many plants back then.
And are the, is the vinyl easily available?
The pellets.
Is that what it is? Tell me the process. I know nothing about it. Tell me the process.
It's just PVC plastic, the same as in a PVC pipe.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So easy to get the materials.
Yes.
It's just the machines.
Just the machines and the manpower and knowledge to run those machines efficiently. Mm-hmm. You know, you could turn a press on and have some guy who knows what he's doing pressing, and that press could break down in 6 hours. You know, something's going wrong. You're using steam and pressure and... who knows? There's a bunch of moving parts that can go wrong.
How big is the machine?
It's about the size of a refrigerator, the manual.
Refrigerator laying down?
Standing up.
Standing up.
Yes.
It's an upright machine.
Yes. And then the automateds are sort of like a giant, like car-sized almost, wide and tall. Because they have spaces where when the record's done pressing, it goes and rests in a, you know.
So knowing about supply and demand, we see there's tremendous demand to have these things made.
Yeah, yeah.
Why have not all the companies who are making all these things, why have they not retooled? And
I think it comes down to probably people, my guess, would be people who are on the boards of those major labels, which I've been pleading to them to be rebuild their pressing plants again. I think they really need to do it. It's in their best interest, and I think they will make a lot of money doing it and help their artists in lots of big ways. But I think what it is, it's a little bit in their mind, like if you were in a board meeting and you want to be the guy to champion this idea, we should build a pressing plant. You're taking a big risk of being on a losing team that year if it doesn't work out, and you will lose your job. So I think that's what that's probably the number one problem with corporations is people don't want to be on a losing team and get their evaluation at the end of the year showing you were on team loser and you're gone. So a lot of risks don't get taken. Luckily, like in a place like Third Man, where it's sort of like a sole proprietorship, we do nothing but take risks all day long. Everything we do is a bad business move.
Yes.
And in the end of the day, somehow it all makes sense, and we pay the bills with it somehow.
Based on that bad business move and based on it working now, is there no feeling that you can expand drastically and open up pressing plants all over the country and you do what they're not doing?
I'm in a debate about that. I mean, right now, at the pace that we're at with 12 presses that I have, I'm looking at right now probably another 8 years before I get all my money back that I put into this plant.
I see.
So,
is it
every
really...
time you get a dollar, you kind of want to put that dollar back into the plant and buy another press.
Yeah.
But then it just keeps extending this time period of actually breaking even. Which I guess, who cares? One side of my brain, who cares? Another side of my brain, it kind of feels negative. But I think what a lot of people do is not what I'm doing, where I use my own money to fund all this stuff.
Yes.
They would really just get a lot of other investors, and I would just own 10% of the company or something, and they would all get the profits or something like that. But I don't think it's not that kind of a profitable business, you know, where we're selling pizza or T-shirts or something, where is it easy to sell to somebody? Yeah, this is easy money.
But it's something that you're an advocate for. It's different. It's like it's got, it's not, the beauty is it's not pizza.
Right,
do you
right.
know what I'm saying? It's pretty, it's an interesting possibility.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I would like it. And I've thought about other things about maybe there's a secondary thing where I do that with investors and build those plants under a different company or a different wing of Third Man.
Yes.
My first hope would be right now the people who have $1 billion where it's just nothing to them to build a plant. I mean, they should just do it. So, but who knows? We'll see.
Super cool.
Thanks. Yeah.
It's super cool. I'm so glad you did it.
Well, it was great, man. Rick, thanks for talking to me.
My pleasure. Thank you for doing this. This is great.
Thanks to Jack White for coming through Shangri-La to hang with Rick, and to Neil Young for stopping by as well. You can hear Jack White's latest album, Entering Heaven Alive, along with all of our favorite songs from him, The White Stripes, and a sampling of his many side projects at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Also, be on the lookout for details on Neil Young's new album with Crazy Horse, produced by Rick Rubin, very soon. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Ben Tolliday, Eric Sandler, and Jennifer Sanchez, with engineering help from Nick Chafee. Our executive producer is Mia Lobel. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you like this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like the show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented 3 new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at marketmessage2024.com right now. Again, the link to watch is marketmessage2024.com. That's marketmessage2024.com.